Hey, welcome to Wolf's Watch. Today we have Dr. Esther Zeledon. I hope that is correct. Esther, I apologize. I forgot to ask the correct pronunciation. And, you know, just as we were talking, we had a great pre-show, and I just immediately, I immediately closed out the intro that I wanted to read. So as you're watching this, laugh with me, laugh at me, just laugh and come along on the conversation. So here, I want to make sure we frame this properly. Dr. Zeledon helps businesses, governments, NGOs, and individuals scale and reach their highest aspirations. Now, this translates to working with corporate and institutional teams that are seeking strategic growth and deeper impact to define and integrate their shared vision into strategic and tactical plans, effective ESG programs, integrated communication strategies, and complete project management systems. Also, it includes advising governments to help them change systems and policies so that funding opportunities match the needs on the ground, coaching individuals to help them transfer their personal professional lives by aligning to their purpose and developing personalized tactical plans that overcome short-term barriers and build long-term results. Dr. Zeledon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yes, and you know, there's so much to talk about. I'm excited about this. But I really want to start with your scuba diving.
So, oh, of course. Yeah.
Because I did a lot of skin diving when I was younger, in the teens and into early 20s. And when I learned about that, I was just like, that is so cool. Plus, it was relatively recent.
Yeah. So I'll be honest with you that I was deathly afraid of learning how to scuba. So
really?
Afraid. Yeah. And what's crazy about it is that my training is actually environmental science. And, you know, and I would spend my summers in fuel stations. Everyone around me was a scuba diver, wow. But I was afraid. I was afraid of being in a tank, in the water, everything. Mm-hmm. So it took me years. I actually thought I probably would never do it. But with my work with localization, which basically translate that it's work where you empower local actors to become leading of their own development, I met this really cool community leader. And so he owned his own diving shop, and his passion was scuba, and the way he talked about the biodiversity and the corals and the shipwrecks and the whole world. He's like, you can only see it through scuba. And he's so amazing. Yeah. I was like, that's it, Esther. That's it. That's it. You got to get over it, and you got to learn it, because you got to scuba with him. It's like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so I learned it just to be able to scuba with him. And then, of course,
nice. You know,
then I became in, like, then once I, my fear's gone, right? Now I love it. And I'll be scuba all the time. But
and it does make such a huge difference, you know, just from skin dive. I learned to skin dive in the Great Lakes, and it's very cold. The water is very clear, so you're good. I mean, even 20 to 30 feet of water, there's a thermal where when you get to somewhere around 20 feet or so, the temperature drops to low 50s. So wow. It's really without a wetsuit. Yeah. Well, as a teenager.
You know, wow.
The stuff we can do, right?
Yeah.
Go diving for an hour and my lips would be purple the rest of the day. But, wow. But it was just so different because you could actually see and experience it.
Yeah.
In the water, as opposed, there's just no way that film, documentaries, and I grew up as a Jacques Cousteau fan. There's no way that can compare to actually being there.
No, and the mindfulness that you experience underwater. I think for me, it also taught me how to do like breathing. There was so many times like my mask would fall off and you can't see anything. I was like, okay, I got to trust the person I'm with. I got to breathe and calm down. And there's nothing else I can think about. For me, it was like the ultimate clearing of your mind. And it's absolutely beautiful. And seeing these ships, actually, history. And we were like, you know, we were picking up even the bottles from like old, like 1500. It was amazing.
Wow.
Amazing. Anyways, since you do scuba, I totally recommend going to the Northern Dominican Republic and doing it with this community leader. It's an experience.
That would be. And there's so much history. You know, it's just somebody had interviewed as a CEO that I'd interviewed several years ago, and his classic CEO. He and I had actually done some consulting work together.
Oh, cool.
Back in the day, but he's just like, you know, Mr. Smooth, little, you know, very little emotion. It's, you know, he's kind of guy. So, how you doing, Jerry? Great. Could you expand on it? I'm doing very great. Thank you. And he got talking about having gone on an archaeological dig, and all of a sudden the 8-year-old kid comes out. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's just in made me think of that when you mentioned here you're diving and you get to see these ships that have been sitting where they are for sometimes hundreds of years. You all of a sudden you're holding a bottle in your hands that's from, you know, the 16th century. And it's just because then he's like going, yeah, it's like you dig your hands in the dirt and all of a sudden you're holding something that's 3,000 years old that nobody's seen since the last person touched it before it went to where you found it.
Exactly. And there's like these tiles too, and like that most of the colonial zone is made out of. And you're like, whoa, this is where they transported it. And plus 400-year-old coral. That's absolutely amazing. Like no picture can capture those colors. No, it's just unbelievable. It's so beautiful. And more doing it with the community leader that just that is their life, their passion, their purpose, everything. Yeah, it's incredible.
That makes such a huge difference.
Yeah.
Having an opportunity to work with someone that's just, they're on fire.
Exactly. And you just like want to go with them. You're like, take my hand, take me. show me the world through your eyes.
Yes. Yeah. There, which ties into the work that you do professionally.
Yes,
you know, exactly. That helping people bring that in, build that into their organizations, the importance of alignment, of mindfulness.
Yes, exactly.
In day-to-day, especially in the leadership roles.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, one of the things, like the movement that like I'm pushing is, and that I was a part of, is like this, I think I was mentioning localization. So it's the whole thing about putting local actors and their voices in the lead. So if for people that are not as familiar with development, the traditional model is I have this money, I want to make a difference, right? Whether you're a philanthropist, whether you're USAID, World Bank, whatever thing. And I am going to take my idea and put it on that community, like my own vision on how they need to do things. And the shift, this movement is, no, like instead of you bring in your own idea, your own thing that once you take it there, how do you even know that they want it? How do you know that it's their purpose and their vision? You know, and this is why like development after 5 years fails. So instead of that, it's really putting them in the lead of it. You're funding what they want to do, what they need, what they aspire to. And so that is really all my work is around. You know, I started in environmental science because I always wanted to like help and make a difference in the world. But in that, it's why I was attracted to environmental science, was because that has to bring in government, that has to bring in private sector, has to bring in people, behavior change, everyone to the table to solve a problem. And then I was like, well, actually, the approach of where you solve environmental problems can be applied to like actually everything. And then that's when I transitioned to more like a broader thing of localization, because even environmental problems aren't really environmental. They are one part, but they're governance, they're social, this, they're that. And so localization is nice because it's a whole approach. It's really shifting that power, that whole colonization type movement, decolonizing it, really putting it at the heart of the people who need it and letting them dictate it. And then where alignment ties in is that, you know, I used to get a lot of pushback in development. Like, wait, you're asking us to change the way we do things. And you're asking us to, we have to procure funds. We don't have time for that and all stuff. And the thing is that there is a way to align both. So you can have like your global, regional, everything priorities. And even of, you know, even if your business, let's say you have even a foundation, anything. You can align it with what the community needs. It might not be in that one community you selected, but it could be in one nearby. And so it's also like opening your mind to, okay, so maybe like we're not aligned here, but maybe we're aligned here. And so that's the approach. Like I proved like in my time in the Dominican Republic was, okay, I grew from scratch, like a whole office from 700,000 to 80 million using this approach. I'm like testing it. Hey, let's go listen to all these communities. Let's hear what it is, the themes. Let's tie it to our global regional priorities. Let's bring in the private sector on their priorities, make these linkages. And then if we're aligning people's purpose and mission from both sides, then you can have huge impact and you get everyone on board.
Exactly. That's where the magic happens. Exactly. And you don't end up with those errors in mission where
Exactly.
The local community's going, gee, we really appreciate the community center, but you know, a water well would have helped a lot.
Exactly. You know how many stories I have on that of like these people brought in latrines and then in like 2 years they're gone and you're like, what happened to them? They're like, oh, we actually really wanted roofs, but we didn't want to say no to the money, so we took the latrines, but then now we're using that material to make roofs,
and they're immediately not even repurposed them once the cameras left.
Exactly. And they're not even the best roofs. Well, the NGO's like, I could have built them roofs. But it's like this mm-hmm. it goes on both sides, right? One is the organization not listening, but it's also them not communicating their needs. And so it requires this transformation from both sides. And that's my mm-hmm. work, is helping on both levels. Organization change the way so they listen, and also on the community, NGO, government level, being able to find what their purpose mission is and actually express it and communicate it and filter it. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the focus on, hey, what's really needed on the, you know, in the local area on the ground.
Yep.
And to bring that to the table, because I worked for an organization that was kind of a hybrid nonprofit, and it was eye-opening coming from the private sector, seeing how it's like, okay, we'll release this block funding to you, but here's all the strings that are attached to it. And it's like, going, why don't you just keep the money? Because it drives it so far off.
Yeah.
It makes it so complicated that not that much of the help actually gets where it needs to go.
Yep.
Or it ends up just being completely derailed because it's not what's really needed. And it's like, geez, you know, yep. You'd almost be better off saying no and finding another way to do it.
Exactly. Saying no to that one and saying yes to one that they do accept, mm-hmm. right? What is your purpose mission that you want? And mm-hmm. then like the next level of it is like, you know, another thing that, you know, I work on is really like systems. Is you can have one NGO, one community that may want one thing, but how do you know that's the voice of the entire system? And so you do have to bring in all the stakeholders in that one area, right? Multiple NGOs, multiple governments. What is that shared vision so that you're not funding just like what four people want? And that it's actually what the whole thing wants, right? So there's different levels of shared visioning mission. And seeing how each one fits in that pie, because that's the other problem. And the other like stories I have is that like, the, you know, the government will have like this fund and say, yeah, local organizations apply for it. Then they make a clinic and then they expect the government to send a doctor or nurse. And the government's like, but there's a clinic 5 miles away. That doesn't make any sense. I can't send you another doctor or another nurse. So there's also like that disconnect too, that the people have to. It has to be something where all the stakeholders also agree with if you are expecting the continuity long term. Yeah.
Or to have somebody come out and go, yes, it's only 5 miles, but why don't you fly out and spend a day here and let's show you what those 5 miles really are. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And getting that joint buy and make your case as to why, guess what? It's because I don't have a bridge or I don't have this. I don't have access. Right. But it has to be everyone in the same room with this agreed buy-in. Yeah.
Now, you had a very distinguished tenure with USAID.
Yeah.
Could you share some of that story? Because, I mean, that's like, you can't get much more big picture than that.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I started actually, my story there is that I was in academia first. And so how I entered there was they had this program, AAAS, where they brought academics into government and to serve as advisors. And that was an amazing experience because I had the opportunity then to work in all these different countries and all these strategies. And I was basically coming in at a point where same thing, they're trying to come up with their 5-year strategy, each country, and working with all the stakeholders on the ground and also thinking about Congress and everything. And these countries get stuck. Like everyone's arguing and then no strategy, the strategy is just there. And so I would used to come in and be like, okay, Let's instead of focusing on the conflict, let's do shared visioning together. Where is it that we want to go? Rather than all those like minutiae of the earmark and the funding and this and that and this person, like, okay, what can we all agree on? What do we all want the system to look like? And then we go from there on what can we do and what can we do within our parameters.
That is a huge task, though, to get that kind of agreement. Just real quick, I want to interrupt. Tom's saying hello. Tom, how are you? Thanks for being part of the conversation. We appreciate it. You know, as you're watching this is 21st century television. This is live and interactive. So say hello. If you've got questions, comments, bring him to truly be part of the conversation. Always glad to have you with us, Tom.
Hi.
But just from working in corporate environment, you know, before I left corporate and went into consulting, I was working for a Fortune 100 company, and we were building teams at the top level within the company. And that just seemed insurmountable. Just, you know, working with different business units in different states that had different histories. But I can't, that's just one piece of many, many moving parts and constituents that you had to work with to get that kind of agreement at USAID.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's like you have governments, private sector, local leader, community, local governments, the people within the organization, outside. They're humongous systems. But the thing is that I think there is always a common ground. There is something that you can all agree on in terms of like the state of where you want to see things in the future. Mm-hmm. And then if you break that down, there is something in there within those of how you want to see the system, what everyone can agree on that they can work on together. It might not be everything, but you know that this chunk we all agree on, and then that's how you can flesh it out. So I did that. And that was amazing. I did that worldwide, many countries. Yeah. But that's where I got my first taste about systems and stakeholders coming in together and getting that buy-in and having the voices. Cause then I learned about power dynamics between different cultures, different staff, Americans, all that comes into play. And then I was like a formal diplomat and went to work in different countries doing that same type of stuff. And then,
It is actually formally part of the diplomatic corps.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, so wow. I was
formally part of the diplomatic corps. Yeah. And in three countries. And then I went off to, during the diplomatic corps, building that one office I was telling you from the bottom. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Steven Taco's with us. He's saying hello. Hi, Steven. How you doing, my friend? He is the producer of the Dancing Yeti. He's an anti-bullying program. He's also been invited to host some of the award shows in Hollywood.
Cool.
So it's great to have him with us.
Yeah, nice.
They've been living. You wrote a book that's been turned into an animated feature film for children. It's been winning awards.
Oh, amazing. Well, I have two kids. I would love to see that.
Oh, yes. So definitely something to look into. And Tom had a good comment. He was always start with the vision of the outcome.
Yes. Yes.
So that.
Exactly.
And as you were pointing out, you find your common points.
Yes. Cause it's a positive thing, right? Instead of talking about the conflict and the past history and all that tension, right? It's more like positive vision forward, right? What can we agree on together as the vision that we want to see? And the thing is, like, everyone in there that's working on that has some sort of purpose in there, has their own lens on what they think the world needs or what they think this country needs. And so it also gives them a chance to voice that and people to see that commonality and how they define this future state. But I saw that as like the major common ground positive. So in those moments of those tension is coming in there, but it also serves another purpose as well. It also creates like a nice umbrella that people all can work on and feel driven on their everyday, because fine, you do this great strategies, fine, you have a vision, but then in the day to day, how do we know that we're having outcomes?
Yeah.
How do we know we're achieving anything? How do we know the scale? And so that helps like set the, like at least like the phrase, like this is the scale we can reach. This is where we want to go. This is what we need to do. And then you can create like an action plan. So it helps also keeping like the motivation and momentum, because it takes like 5+ years to see like big outcomes in these communities and countries.
Over 5 years to actually start to see the fruit, so to speak, from all that effort.
Yeah. Big outcomes. I mean, you could see successes built over a year or two, but like big systemic change. Yeah, 5. And I think that's what I saw in the DR. I saw some change build one on top of each other, right? By proving this approach that you can fund things that local actors want and need, and also shift that power to them from a donor to the person. you know, we start seeing that movement. Okay, start seeing this one organization grow, start seeing the community start pushing, then leveraging all these funds and growing. And then, you know, everyone coming together. But I mean, when we start seeing like the big chunk of results was after year two. And then, you know, it starts going, it starts multiplying. Year five is when you can see big things. But you have to have that umbrella. If not, it's just focused on outputs. Yeah.
How frustrating and challenging that must be when both the private sector and the public sector tend to move, you know, quarterly. Yes. Think quarterly in terms of funding.
You have
quarterly. Or even annually at the longest. Maybe you can get an annual.
Yeah. No, and I'm not. Okay. Maybe I should rephrase. You do see. Okay. That's how you define results.
Let me back up a second on that. Yeah. Because it's we're so incentivized to look short term, quick results. Exactly. What's the quick hit? What's that quick? Yeah. What can we measure that's going to show? Hey, guess what? We started last month, and here we are this month, yeah. And there we are next month. And you're saying, look, we're not going to start seeing the big results for probably two and a half years.
Yes, big.
Could you share with how that looks in terms of being able to keep that coalition together, that agreement? Yeah. Moving forward for that long.
For sure. So I think like that was a big challenge for when I built that whole office and team, was really breaking down that vision and strategy and, you know, five years, right? But then every year breaking that down into small things, right? So what can we achieve after year one, year two, year three, year four, year five? Year five is the big systemic transformational change. But every year you're seeing shifts in the system and you're measuring it. And every quarter you're measuring it. And so, no, I definitely had to be, we as a team had to be, okay, how are we going to communicate every quarter successes? And also looking past the money and just the outputs, right? Because you can put a lot of results on outputs, right? I mean, that's the traditional development model. How many sanitation units did I create? How many people did I train? How many this, right? And even when we were looking to leverage with the private sector, it also took some time to sit with them because a lot of the corporate social responsibility was based on, well, we do this, we give backpacks, we give scholarships, we give this. And it was to sit down and say, hey, but if you want huge change in that community, like you want them to start owning their own and maintaining their own water systems, that you don't have to provide it for them, this is what's going to have to happen. You need to restore the watershed. It's going to take X amount of, you know, 2 years to grow. You got to have water committees in place where they're going to pick up the water fees. You got to, you know, have advisory committees. It's going to take this long, but each quarter along the way, you can measure certain things, you know, advisory board created, right? This unit, this and that, right? The fees being the system to do the fees, right? Every single thing builds to create that result. So having like a really structured tactical plan that breaks down that big transformation result into pieces and how you're going to get there is, I thought, was step one, because it shows, look, we're fine. We're in progress. Remember, we broke down this five-year thing into this. And every quarter, are we making where we said we were going to do every quarter? Yes. And most of the time, we used to put like buffers, and we were always going ahead of what we thought. And because funding people's visions and passions and mission, they then take it upon themselves to get leveraging, to get this and momentum. And so, like, even in that one, the one thing in Northern DR, you know, the community, they ended up getting leveraging from themselves with government. They ended up getting other things and working with NGOs, things that we didn't even have in our plan that naturally happened. And like, and also with the government, just by convening them together. And even the donors, like, hey, we're going to fund this entity to have them lead. Then they were like, oh, you know, as you bring people together, oh, well, I can fund you too. I can fund you too. And so by doing that, you start putting in more money and more stuff. And so that vision strategy, if it's clear and it's outlined and it's like very well, like, planned and put out, you can then people see, okay, you there is an idea, there is movement. And then they want to join in as well. Right, because it's something that was co-created with everyone together. Yeah,
and success breeds success. When people see that there's energy, it's like the scuba diver, the gentleman had the dive company. It's like when you have that kind of energy, someone, you know, look, you go, okay, I want to be part of this. Then other people see that and go, okay, well, we want to go too.
And they start coming,
and plus they're seeing actual tangible results.
Exactly. I used to
I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, no,
no, no. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask about, measuring outcomes. So often in the private sector and business world, there's times where we get caught up measuring things because they're convenient to measure, and it's going, oh, look at this. This is really improving. It's like, well, it's not connected to anything in reality that's helping the organization, but yeah, that's nice. But it seems we measure what's convenient, and it seems that that's a challenge in the arena that you've been working in as well. How do you identify the right things to measure, especially when it's not like you can take a tape measure and go, okay, we're going to measure this. We'll lay the tape out and we can see that we're moving forward.
Yeah.
A foot every year. You know, it's not as a physical, tangible measurement. Can't measure in business. If nothing else, we can always default to, hey, look, we invested X dollars in and we got X times whatever out in terms of profit at some point in the future.
Yeah. But you can mesh the two. So, I mean, because even in my line of work, we had our, you know, congressional targets, and mm-hmm. we had to report them up and the traditional formats. And so we would do that, but then, you know, I would take it to the next level, right? Cause we say that we only want quantitative, right? Fine. I could give you that, provide that, but this personal story and the story of transformation, that is something that even in every type, even with the private sector, government, country level, that people were interested in hearing. And I used to be very strategic and bring in, for example, because not everyone in the organization could come to the field. You know, we used to go every month and I would take different people. I would take even the finance person to the contracting person. I would take them out so they could see what they were approving, because they couldn't, like, they were like,
brilliant.
No, I want you to go see it. I want you to meet them. I want you to see the passion. And then, you know, and then with the, you know, during the beginning of the pandemic, I remember I brought a community leader into one of the larger meetings of the organization just for him to speak. And he would say there, like, this is the first time the organization's actually come to talk to me and ask me what I need. And this is how much that means to me and why I'm so committed to this. And this is what I've built and shown it on video. That, even though that's outside the traditional reporting,
mm-hmm.
that leaves an imprint of everyone working there. They all feel that they're contributing to something, you know?
And isn't that really what was intended with the traditional reporting?
Yes.
You know, that's the real outcome. That's what we're actually trying to do.
Yeah.
And even in business, it's about, you know, did the individual customer
exactly
served well? Did they get what they were looking for? Did they have a good experience in working with us on getting that? Yet it's not, you know, now we've got better tools to start aggregating those experiences, but it's easier to measure other stuff. So we'll measure that and then we'll look at these numbers and we risk getting that disconnected.
Yeah. And testimonials, because it's a type of testimonial. Testimonials still go a very long way. And so do pictures and documentation. Like, we were able to show pictures of what it looked like before and then what it looked like after, not just through the interventions of ours, but how bringing in everything from the system, what the government puts in, private sector, what donors put in, how it transformed. And so I think, like, that, just those visuals, people are humans. And so, you know, they you have your numbers that you have to do, but people are still moved by stories, by stories of alignment, by testimonials. Mm. That's still, you know, I was like, you know what? I think we should tell Congress these stories. And then we started putting them in outside the traditional thing. And then it started booming. It wasn't something that, you know, was, you know, people were doing very often, but it was definitely welcomed. And so I think we can, you know, even if it doesn't exist in the current system, doesn't mean that you can't incorporate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so.
Well, there's a powerful statement right there. Just because it doesn't exist in the current system doesn't mean you can't incorporate it.
Exactly. And yeah, exactly. Like, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that I did. And at first, you know, that
you're just a troublemaker.
Yeah. Probably. I think when I mentioned to you about the environmental science, you know, in college, I was that major didn't exist when I was in college. And I told my college, I'm going to create it. I'm going to create my major because I think this is what I see that's a need in the future. And I want to be positioned for it. So I'm going to create it and I'm going to take all these classes and piecemeal it together. And at first, everyone thought I was crazy. But you know what? Then look, now it's like in every university, right? Most
of
it.
Yes.
So,
and it all started with the program you put together.
And so I see that with local, like I saw that with localization too. I was like, I pioneered it. And now it's the buzzword in development in the donor world. And now like people are like, Esther, can you tell us how you did it? But at first I had to face the resistance. Like, yes, this doesn't exist, but this is what makes sense. This is why we all joined. We all joined to help these people and fund them.
Could you share one or two ahas that were surprising at the time when you were going through that, you know, where you're creating the environmental program, you know, the academic program focusing on environmental sciences that didn't exist when you're putting together these coalitions and creating the localization programs when they didn't, you know, leading that kind of really trailblazing.
Yeah.
With doing it.
The aha moment, I think my biggest one is really, and I think that's one of the reasons why I also do like coaching now, because I think one of the ahas was really listening to myself and my inner compass. And I think that's the first thing, my aha was like that mindset thing of like believing that, you know what, it doesn't matter that everyone, you know, it's just, they're not there yet. And I have to believe and follow it. And so for me, it was first that, and like, so, you know, it doesn't exist. So I had to like follow my gut on what and the piecemealing. And I was like, well, I think I need a little bit of biology. I need earth science. I need social science. I need this, and kind of created on what I thought would be useful in solving that problem. And so I made it more about what are my tools that I can use to serve. And that was the same like aha moment with localization, that I was like, okay, it's the same thing. I want to create this movement where we allow people to live their mission, purpose, and vision and get the opportunity to live it, right? Get funding for it. And that's that went deep in me too, right? Because I think that society too also pushes us to check marks. And so it's kind of like, okay, you know, how I have to think about that, like, what are the barriers to that? And so when you're creating it, what do they need? And what needs to change so that we can create those opportunities in those spaces? And so it was about solving the problem. And so there was a lot of aha lessons learned because I was not prepared. I think I had way more resistance later in during my career than I did in college. I think college was kind of like, that's very odd, Esther, but okay. But in you know, in the work environment, right, it's a lot of relationships and you have to get that buy-in. And then there's some resistance because people want to stay status quo and they can't see that vision that I see. And so how do you bring people together? So the change management, organizational psychology, like I had to get certain certifications along the way to give me tools that I didn't have right away. Yeah.
Because, there's a lot of inertia. Everybody's got inertia in some direction and they've got their goals and they're looking at it like this. And it's like, no, we're not going to do that. I'm doing it this way. Right? I had a vice president of operations at a company that was tied into a doom loop and they're laying people off. And I'm sitting across the table again. Right. And I'm sitting across the desk from him and he's going, this is great. We know exactly what we got to do, but we just can't do it for 3 years. Because that was his retirement date.
Oh.
And it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, but you're not going to have 3 years. could you share a little bit in how, especially as you went out and you got more tools and change management and psychology of working with people, how that helped to overcome that kind of resistance and to help with the alignment. You know, we were talking in the pre-show about alignment is huge and is such a complicated, difficult thing to pull off in practice.
Yeah. No, it helped me a lot because I think it helps you have that understanding of like the system and different incentives that people have. And you have to understand that. And it's kind of that whole process of everyone else has their own vision, purpose, or reason or incentive of being in that position or that job. And so you have to understand what are their all their incentives, what are their barriers. You know, whatever you propose is going to make either their job better or more difficult. And so I start, you know, learning all those power dynamics that exist and incentives, and then thinking about, okay, that's when I started to like realize, okay, the whole shared visioning is so important, because everyone has their own incentives, their own alignment. And so bringing people around one shared thing, it helps move the movement. So that's the biggest thing I learned from it, that you can learn all those little aspects of people, and that could help on the one-on-one basis. But to really create the structure that everyone can feel empowered to become your ally, there has to be an umbrella that everyone is bought into, like agrees on and was able to contribute to. Yeah.
So it also sounds like it took a lot, you invested a lot of time in relationship building.
Yes, lots. Yeah. And not internally and externally. Externally too, with the communities and leaders and all the external actors as well, because they're used to whatever entity functioning in a certain way, and you're telling them to trust you in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do they know to trust you? How do they know to give you money or time? And so it's also,
and it's a big ask too, that trust.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of it comes with little steps. Like, okay, if you tell me if you're an organization that needs capacity, you have your own vision and you need to build your capacity, you have to be willing to take that information and also being able to fund them later so that they could grow, right? You're not just going and extracting, that you're going to, you know, give a portion back, you're going to partner with them, you're going to link them to something. So it has to be mutually beneficial. And so you have to build that trust with like little tidbits and like listen to them. If they're telling you, hey, I don't see you enough. Okay, how often do you want to see me? And this is what works in my schedule. So having a lot of that conversation and back and forth and really sticking to it. That's how you're building the trust that, you know, I listen to you. And so I'm here. You know, if you want to see me every quarter, I'm here. Like whatever works with you, but that you are not just like going there and ghosting.
Wait a minute. You're saying that once we have this long conversation and we work all this stuff out, then I actually need to stick to it going forward. Oh, man.
Yeah. But there's a lot of empty promises, right? Or people don't follow up.
Sometimes it's intentional. It's empty promises. Sometimes it's not having that. Earlier in my career, it was a big awakening for me to realize how much of a fishbowl we operate in.
Yeah.
You know, and people watch. They're watching close, especially, you know, we're saying, trust me. And you build the trust with them. And they're like going, okay. And they're looking for just an indication that the trust is misplaced and it gets pulled back.
Yeah. And it's also being like expectations all the time and clear. Mm-hmm. You're constantly communicating, because it's okay if you derail, but that you pick up the phone and you're like, this is what happened. Just so you know, this is going to be a delay. But a lot of times like that communication channel gets eroded or, you know, and all of that. And so I think it's like that. It's like that relationship matters to you, that it's not just like, oh, you know, I'm a donor and you're a beneficiary, whatever. No, it's like, I see you as a partner with me and we're going to do this together and I'm going to communicate it and make sure that expectations are clear. Or if you go to a community to listen, be like, I am just here to listen. I can't promise anything. Just setting those expectations, just that alone builds trust, that they know, okay, there's no money, but you're here to listen. Or, okay, you know, this is what you can do. Or, okay, I'm not going to hear from you for 6 months to a year because of whatever processes. But just that helps like set the tone for things that maybe you don't even control. But I was shocked to hear that a lot of them were like, no one's ever communicated, no one follows up, you know. And so I think a lot of that, just that alone, you know, it's really big for a lot of places. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And it's a sad truth. that too often. You see that in big, you know, in big pictures and in smaller, some small companies I've worked with, and you see communication errors like that. And then it's obvious in hindsight, it's like, oh, how could we have missed that?
Yeah, exactly.
Like the localization program, you know, the initiative or really movement that, that you created, in hindsight, go, yeah, why wouldn't we do it that way? But yet, before you got it started, no one was doing it.
Yeah, it was something like, you know, they had like other terms for it. Like, you know, there was this like whole thing about locally led development, but it was all, a lot of it still, even to, even now, it's mm-hmm. interpreted as, oh, we got to give more money to local organizations, or, oh, we got to do this, like, on a very like superficial level. But the actual, when you really have to shift the power, it does require you to have deeper relationships and a shift from the technical skill to the soft skill as well, which is super taboo.
That's in huge. Both
business and development, because we do value more, and we put value on technical skills or years of experience on, you know, and all these job things. But in reality, for a lot of this work, we're looking for people who are good listeners, who are good facilitators, who can do these visioning sessions with organizations. And so it also puts the question to us, like, how are we hiring? How are we putting out positions? What is really our objective? Why do we feel this need to impose our technical expertise in certain areas? Mm-hmm. So it puts the question a lot of our culture too.
You've truly led on a global scale.
Yeah.
Is it really leading at that level, or just leadership in general? Is it really more about what we've commonly started calling the soft skills? Is that more the essence of leadership than the technical stuff?
I, in my belief, yes, I think it is a lot of soft skills. It's a lot of, I guess, facilitation, listening, empathy, kindness. I remember there was a myth when I was moving up the ladder, I guess you could say. And I remember I had somebody tell me, oh, Esther, you're too kind. You're too empathetic. That's a weakness. As you move up, you got to be hard. You got to be like tough and aggressive as a woman to move up. And I remember that feeling super uncomfortable. And I was like, why do I have to be that way to move up the chain? And then you come to realize that that's completely not true. Actually, I felt that I had the most success because I led through empathy, through kindness, and through active listening. And like that, you know, I was made sure that as the team, you're always adapting, right? You're adapting to the needs of the team and to the people in your circle. You're making sure that you're making the adjustments necessary, that so you're moving along the mission, vision, and bringing them up as leaders with you. And so I saw that it's not my technical skills in science that helped me with that. It was more of that's what they call still soft skills, which I don't really like the word soft because they're not soft, but that's how we refer them to even in our culture, right? Refer them as soft.
Yeah. But I don't know where that started, but it minimizes what it's really all about. I mean, I'm a recovering engineer.
Okay.
and I got into engineering because they were hiring. And I grew up in the Midwest, and it was becoming the Rust Belt at that time. But it was, you know, that was, fortunately, I had mentors that kept after me going, look, this is what it's about. If you really want to move forward, if you want to have an impact, these are the things that you need to really make a lifelong journey of honing.
Yeah.
So that you can be better at influencing other people, so that I can be present, accountable, and ready to serve.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of that perspective of being there to serve in order to accomplish the mission, the larger mission in what you've done.
Yes, yes. And learning how to communicate it as well across wide range of audiences. You know, I would have to justify it up, lateral, below, community level, being able to translate that same impact across all different people and audiences on the spot. and see it through a bigger lens, I think it's another type of skill, right? The strategy skill.
Yes.
And communicating. Yes. You know, when you have to use numbers, use numbers. When you can use stories, use those stories. When you need to say it to you know, different people, you know, there's a different language in each of the field, right? Through business, through the communities, different interests, but being able to still describe that. It's another skill set on its own, and writing.
Could you share a little bit about the difference in power dynamics? You'd mentioned that earlier. Because especially you see that within organizations, but geez, when you're talking dealing with different countries, dealing with federal government interests just within the United States, there's a lot of different things happening there.
No. There's so many layers of power dynamics. There's internal power dynamics, external power dynamics, stakeholder. And so a lot of that systems work of understanding your system beforehand is really mapping it out and sharing those maps before you even meet on who are the power structures. Because you also have to be careful when you put everybody in the room that who you know who's in power, you may have to do separate conversations to make sure that everyone's voice is heard, make sure that no one's being left out of that, you know, their voice. And so even within, you know, countries, right, you can have different levels of different systems working around each other, and there's different power structures. So you can have like one community where the mayor has all the power and he's the one that decides what aid comes in or doesn't. You can have another community where the community leader is the one that's trusted and has all the power. And so you need to know, okay, I need to have that person's buy-in. But then how does that dynamic, if I put them all in the same room, would everyone else speak? And then what if I remove that actor? What is that conversation like? And so the power dynamics plays into a lot into development, because it tells you, it gives you a picture of who's the one that makes the decisions, who's the one that lets things in or out, who's the one that people trust in terms of communicating and follow and lead, who's maybe the person they're fearful of. And mm-hmm. also there's the power between, and I think we were talking about it, between donors.
Yep. Yes.
That can mean individual, that can mean federal, that can mean private sector, you know, whatever, donors and beneficiaries. And then how do we shift that power to the beneficiary is another power structure. And that's the localization movie, is like shifting that power to them where they are leading, they are dictating what they want and we fund it. They're the ones who are convening, and we fund those convenings as, you know, as, and I mean, we as general, like donors, mm-hmm. businesses, anybody sure. who's donating and helping. To switch that structure of, you know, rather than the I dictate, I give into.
There's that tendency to look, we donated this money, so we want it exactly. spent this way.
Exactly. And more instead of, they voiced it. We have, you know, whoever has the means, whoever's mm-hmm. aligned with their vision funds it. And then, you know, but it's co-created nice. Together. That is one huge shift of power that I think is like the first step. Mm-hmm. Is changing those models. And then the other power dynamics is, how do you make sure that everyone is in the room that needs to be there for that shared perspective?
And it's draws on three of the themes that I think I've been hearing. I want to ask, make sure I'm getting this right. No, because you mentioned staying true to your core, you know, your core values, being clear on that and sticking to it.
Yeah.
The importance of alignment.
Yeah.
In relationship building.
Yeah.
In order to have all of that just as the core for being able to have a shot at being able to get the rest of that to work.
Yeah. And that applies to anything. You have a team and you're working in a company, you're not aligned, your employees are not bought in, they're not going to care about your organization or your mission, right? And that goes for any team structure, any NGO, any government office. And if you have ever all your people aligned and they understand what they're doing, they understand the mission, why I'm here, that's when you get the results,
right? Everyone should be striving towards having the community they serve respond the way that you did to the person that helped you get your scuba diving cert and become so passionate about scuba diving. Exactly. And also the people, I imagine, on his team that work within his dive company are probably pretty passionate and having a good time at what they do as well.
Exactly. And he's actually, how he started was a fisherman. And they found this as an alternative livelihood of doing that. And so, you know, they know those waters in and out, and it's amazing. So everyone that's with him is like so passionate about it. And you feel it. Like when you have a team that, like you said, that feels it, you feel it and you want to be part of it. Even if it's something different, you know, I wanted to be part, I wanted to go with them. I was like, take me with you. I want to go. Yeah,
exactly. Well, yep. It's just, you know, over the years, there's some organizations that, especially like my first job out of college, to this day, I still use it. I pull lessons and use examples, and I'm proud of having worked with that organization. I learned so much from the experience. There's other organizations I worked with where it's like, you know what? You'll never hear me mention them because it just was not a great experience. Yeah. Like, oh, no, I wouldn't wish that on, you know, people I didn't like, kind of a thing. And I get a sense that now that you've taken all these experiences and you're coaching other leaders and emerging leaders, that you're helping them bring that perspective and an understanding of, okay, here's, as you're coaching them, the result being that they can start to understand how they can create that kind of environment.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was a pivotal moment for me last year where I realized that I actually was always doing localization my whole entire life. You know, I've always worked with people, listening to people, aligning them with their strengths. I think since I was like in high school, you know, achieving the purpose, I think I was even mentioning to even in college. But I realized that the key thing, like, even though I had been in development for so long, you know, and I was at this pivotal moment, do I continue? Do I go to another country? I thought, you know, my purpose vision is so much bigger. You know, I this needs to become a movement, become something that's normalized. Well, on one side of people living their own purpose and vision, you know, it's like this whole, still that's taboo and still people live checkmark lives, whatever everyone tells them to. And then they struggle in their business and development or anything, being able to help people achieve theirs because they don't even know how to do theirs. And so I kind of saw that too. And then, like, you know, and then there's like the NGO world. And so then I was like, you know, I need to, this, my calling is to help people figure out what it is and their purpose and their alignment. And then also help NGOs being able to figure that out, and businesses and teams, and helping these do these visioning sessions. That's what gives me the energy. And then when they come out of those sessions with that shared vision, with that excitement, kind of like the scuba example I was telling you, they come out feeling like, yes, you know, I know where I need to go and I have a plan, or as, you know, and that could be as a person, an organization, a team. That whole, like, that amazing feeling that I know where I'm going and this is what feels good, and I share it with these people, that is what fuels me. And that I know that if everyone had that, I know we could have a reduction of anxiety, depression, crime and violence, everything, you know? And so, so I'm just, it's like, it's, that's what I do. And so I have.
And what a legacy to build.
Yeah, that's my, like, that's the legacy. Exactly.
I worked, had a consulting engagement with a company from Japan, and my counterpart, when we were doing the outbrief at the end, started talking about the organization and the 400-year plan that they had. I'm like, going, it's hard to think a year, maybe 2 to 5 in the American business world. And here, this company's framework for how they look at what they do is, how do we want to be perceived in 400 years, which begged questions like, well, what can we know about that so far in the future? So which frame, what can we talk about? And then that flowed back into, it was able to show how that really flowed back into their day-to-day policy and decision-making, which was phenomenal to be so tightly aligned to a grand long-term vision like that.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I hope not 400 years, but
the type you're sowing the seeds that could very easily lead to at some point in, you know, university or in K-12, they're going, well, you know, this all started 300 years ago with this program that Dr. Zeladin put together.
Yeah. That
in, would. in uh,
Exactly. That would be.
I have a question along those lines, though. Yeah. Pulling that timeline in a little bit. If we were to sit down and talk again in 10 years.
Yeah.
Looking back across those 10 years, what would have to have happened for you to be able to say, you know what, this went way beyond my wildest dreams?
Yeah. So I think I was saying it's a movement, right? And I think what I would see in 10 years is that this talk is normalized, that it's everywhere, right? That everyone's like talking about their purpose, and that's taught in school to figure out who it is rather than like picking career tracks, that in school you're taught, hey, what is it that you have? What is your gift to the world? And that already like in future tracks, universities, that it's so much more open. So I think like that would be my 10-year thing, that this is like normalized, mainstream, people figuring out themselves, being open to it, that it's not just a traditional checkmark life. And that, you know, and that I'm known as a person that trailblazed that and pioneered it. And I think that would be my thing in 10 years, that it's this big movement and that I have championed, and I've already, mm-hmm. I've thousands of lives, but it would be amazing to have millions of lives impacted.
Oh, absolutely. And in 10 years, it would be, I could see that being beyond just millions, you know, tens of millions.
Tens, exactly.
Or perhaps more digits, right? It's a big world.
Yep, it is. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. It's exciting.
So how are, I'm watching the time, and I want to be respectful of your time, because I promised that we'd wrap top of the hour. What are you working on now? Because you've made this change where you're helping individuals and other organizations.
Yep.
Implement these types of programs.
Yes. Yeah. So I do on my
Instagram. Sorry, that was a clumsy way to phrase that. It's just like, yeah. what do you got going on now?
Sure. No problem. So I have my Instagram is where I work with individuals. Mm-hmm. Because there's also a characteristics of a person that wants to change the world and, you know, wants to make an impact. You know, there's things about what's keeping them from doing that, what's keeping them from following their own mission, purpose, and vision, and also making an impact. So a lot of that thing on Instagram is, it's a lot more on that mindset shift, being, you know, not being scared to do it, taking those risks, making plans so that they can actually do things that are aligned with them. So on the individual level, I've grown this Instagram page. It's growing. Right now I have like 9,000 plus followers, but it's going up.
Nice. And congratulations.
Yeah, so it's great. And I've had like, you know, a good amount of clients, like 50 clients this year, which is good. And, you know, so that's been growing on the individual level. In terms of But I still have like, I have my other consulting arm, which is for organizations. So I consult with helping, you know, bring this localization movement. I give talks on that. So I gave one to Cornell recently. I gave one to big NGOs like Plan Internacional. So I'm a speaker on the subject, and also helping change policies and shift perspectives with development practitioners. So that's another side. And then there's the third arm, which is the NGO arm. So I serve on boards, and I also help them, one, figure out what their mission, purpose, and vision is and how to scale it, and then how to obtain, create sustainability plans and get funding so they can fund their mission and how to communicate it. Yeah, so I'm working on all those three things.
Wow.
It's really...
And yet it still fits together.
It still all fits together, right? Because it's all under alignment, and it's just different ways the alignment comes together. So my logo actually has... It's the sun, the moon, and the earth. So actually, and the way I see those three arms is each arm represents one of those. And when they are in full alignment, it's called spring tide. And so it's the biggest spring forth. It's the biggest tide that happens when you have the sun, moon, and earth fully aligned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my theory is if by working with all these three, right, if this movement can grow, that all three of these aspects, right, you get the person aligned, you get the beneficiary aligned, you get these donor organizations and businesses all, you know, in this space, we can create that tie together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, might surprise you, if you've been watching Wolf's Watch for any amount of time, you know this is true. As you're watching this, it doesn't surprise you, but I was a little rebellious, and I kept getting this message of going, you know, you need to be part of, it's like one person can't change anything.
Yeah.
But I read, but reading history, you know, as an adult, I've really come to enjoy reading history. And history teaches us it is always one person that's making the difference. Yeah. And you, Dr. Esther Zeledon, are one of those people.
Oh, thank you.
Truly a global leader, truly making a difference, truly changing the arc of history, the arc of how, as people, we're moving forward.
That's the goal. That's why I show up every day.
That is so awesome.
Yeah. I show up every day on social media or on LinkedIn, everything, you know, even when
And it's not just words. It's like going, look here, I've already done it. Here's what you need to do. Right. Yeah. Here's this works. We've done it not just once, but we've repeated it and we've taken it other places. And so here, let me show you, let me coach you on how you too.
Yeah. I think
can be that one in your arena that makes the difference.
Exactly. And together we can create huge change. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
and that is the perfect closing comment right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Esther Zeledon, for being on Wolf's Watch tonight.
Yes. No, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for everyone watching. I loved it.
Yeah. And go to Instagram. That starts your journey. You want to be a global leader, a global influencer, right there. Here. Yes. Let me make it bigger for you. Just if you're like me and you need reading glasses, there you go. Instagram, that's the place to start. If you're already an influencer, if you're already making a difference, follow Esther's example and get more tools. Reach out to Esther and she'll help you continue to build that toolkit so that you can continue to scale your influence and your impact as well.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be your champion.
Awesome. Thank you so much. The legacy that you're creating is just phenomenal.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. And I love this. Yeah.
This has been awesome. Time has gone by so fast and we've really just kind of scratched the surface.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for watching. You know, smash that like button, throw your comments in. If you're watching this on the replay, go ahead and comment and ask questions. We're still watching. If you've got a question, we'll get back to you. I'll make sure that it gets to Dr. Zeledon so she can get an answer for you in,
yes.
As always,
yep.
We'll see you on the trail.
Yes. Thank you.